example of why I couldn't stay in my community. I was going back and forth between the downtown east side and Surrey when I was in the height of my addiction. And I made the choice after leaving treatment, I actually made the choice before I entered treatment, that I was going to be moving up north once I was done. And that's what I did. And I created a life for myself here in Kitimat. And I genuinely do believe that if I had stayed in the Lower Mainland, there's a good likelihood that treatment wouldn't have worked for me. And that's not to say I moved up here magically. I wasn't surrounded by people that were using drugs or partying or whatever, triggers, all of these things. It's not that it was just so much easier. I didn't have my family around. There was a lot of factors that made it difficult, but I knew that I needed to be somewhere different. I needed to start fresh. That was just what I needed. Everyone's experience is going to be different. So I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think that is important to remember, because sometimes staying in community can be detrimental. We do know that, as you mentioned at the end of that there, what you could go back to your community and you've changed, but your community hasn't. And so sometimes it can actually be detrimental. And that is very much so on a case-by-case basis. So I think we need to be able to have flexibility and to have options for people and to be able to determine what is going to best serve them. And I think that really does vary case by case and community by community. But beyond that, disproportionately, even though we have a smaller population because we're not identified, we are disproportionately more affected by these issues. We have issues with homelessness, for example, at twice or more the rate that urban centers do. And that's based on data, that's based on the government's own data. We know that. You're almost twice as likely to be homeless living up north here than you are living in an urban center. So It's difficult because those investments need to be made and we need to catch up. But I understand also that the government is dealing with an issue of exploding population growth in urban centers. And so they're trying to catch up there as well. So it would really be about looking at overall budgets and figuring out how we can make sure the money is getting allocated to the places that it needs to be. And that starts with trying to ensure that we're not spending on things that don't need to be spent on. There are solutions here. I have raised many of them, and I have many more that I will continue to raise through my time in this work. But there needs to be a willingness from government to listen and to work with both sides of the house. And at this point, I have not seen that.
Okay. Can you give me some of those concrete solutions that you are raising when you're in legislature? What are some of those concrete ones, especially ones that really address the crisis here in the North?
Certainly, yeah. So the first one is just a lack of availability. It's a lack of investment into treatment beds. We just don't have them. So we need to get treatment centers up here. I know there are a number of excellent treatment centers that are operating already in other parts of the province that have approached me that would be so happy to open treatment centers up here in the north. They would love to do that. They want to do it. But again, the government's saying, sorry, we have no money. We can't help. And unfortunately, the reality is most people that need access treatment can't afford to pay privately. They just can't. So it's also looking at those other intermediary stages like sober living facilities. When we look at what's going on with supportive housing in this province, it's absolutely astonishing. It's mind-blowing to see how they are handling this. We know already that investing in things like sober living facilities and intermediary stage after treatment is infinitely more effective in ensuring that people are less likely to relapse. Why wouldn't we make those investments? So making that investment, rather than having to put them through treatment 2, 3, 4 more times, it's a simple no-brainer, but the government does not look at long-term solutions. There are a lot of different concrete solutions here. But again, if the government's not willing to listen, then all I can do is just keep trying. But at this point, I've not been successful in getting them to recognize that there are a lot of really valuable solutions out there that in the long term would actually cost far less money for the government. If that's what it's going to come down to, if it's going to come down to just a simple dollar and cents, there is a way to do it. But they're just not willing to.
Okay. Emily Rattay, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Of course. Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
As BC's decriminalization pilot for small amounts of illegal drugs comes to an end, public health officials are being asked to assess what the policy changed, particularly for people who use substances in northern and rural communities. In the Skeena and Northwest regions, barrier to care, limited anonymity, and ongoing toxicity in the unregulated drug supply continue to shape overdose risk. I spoke with Dr. Jong Kim, Chief Medical Officer with Northern Health, about whether decriminalization reduced stigma what health risks concern him most as possession becomes criminalized again, and which harm reduction measures have proven most effective in the North. Here's that interview now.
Hi, my name is Jong Kim. I'm Chief Medical Health Officer with the Northern Health.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Kim, for taking the time to speak with me. I'd like to start right in. From a public health perspective, what effects did decriminalization have on stigma for people who use substances in the Skeena region, particularly in smaller or rural communities where services and anonymity are pretty much limited?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I think that the decriminalization, one of the key intention is that acknowledging that addiction is a health issue and the stigma, and that it's important part of barrier to access, and by separating people from the criminal justice system to increase access to care they need and support they need. From what we have been seeing and experiencing during the pilot period, that those intended outcomes have not been kind of delivered. So we are focusing on, we continue to focus on those measures that we know it works and save lives there. So in terms of stigma, during the period that we've seen and what we hope to achieve with the destigmatization, we have not seen that the reduction and the lowering barriers through the decriminalization that we can hope for there. It is important to note that some of that purchasing and acquisition practice and behavior is different in some of the smaller community compared to urban communities, including how they are accessing and possessing drugs. So it's important that we are aware and we continue to support that those kind of measures that kind of save lives there.
Many communities feel like there is still a stigma around even checking that your drugs are safe, which really is, it's such a vital step now, for more recreational users, just with so many variances with extremely toxic and deadly substances that are just being found in so many of the drugs that are within our communities. So with possession of small amounts becoming criminalized again, and just for reference for our listeners, decriminalization was for 2.5 grams or less of an illegal substance was not a criminal amount to possess anymore. But with these small amounts becoming criminalized again, Dr. Kim, what health risks concern you most? And I guess it's for this, I'm referring maybe to people going back to more solitary drug use practices indoors and the potential impact on overdose prevention sites in Northern BC.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that it's important to note that unregulated drug poisoning continues to be a significant emergency, like in the North and including Northwest communities. And the important part of that is, as you've kind of noted, that the toxic contamination of the kind of drug and drug supplies there. The main thing we are focusing on is those intentions that we try to achieve through these criminalization and other measures continue to be important, that we are lowering barriers and connecting people with the necessary care. And those kind of services that protect people from the toxicity of that, some of the contaminated drug supply, including kind of drug checking, providing the support and connections that they can safely consume when they do, for example, through the overdose prevention services, as well as connecting when they need and when they seek that they get necessary care and treatments, including mental substance use, will continue to be really important.
But Northern communities already face barriers like limited access to supervised consumption, detox, and treatment services. So in your professional opinion, how does recriminalization intersect with the gaps in services that I mentioned? And then what does that mean for health outcomes in this region?
I think that this will be part of our continued kind of evolve and kind of focus approach to what works in our emergency kind of situations in our response. We are focusing on the measures that it hasn't shown to be effective there. For the Northern Health side, like we ensure and continue to work on increasing and sustaining those kind of access to treatments and harm reduction and services, and continue to support our community partners that provide really important necessary services in our community, and also working a broader partnership, like including like RCMP, which we understand that taking the measures approach with the change in the decriminalization kind of policy.
I did reach out to RCMP as well to have them speak on this topic, but at this time they cannot make any comment. But Dr. Kim, I do wonder, and if I can just press on just one thing that you said, what measures have been the most effective in the North?
There are key measures, like we've seen some of the kind of changes made. I think, you know, like particularly this continued to be important, naloxone and increasing and expanding access and availability of naloxone. We've seen that in overdose prevention services we provided, that how it actually prevents some of the high-risk kind of situations and make a difference, like right away, saving the life as well as reducing a potential harmful effect from the toxicity of the kind of drug supplies. Drug checking continued to be important, both for that providing important tool for individuals that they can use to aware and approach their consumption of the practice of the drug, as well as providing the community and healthcare providers to be aware what are the toxicity of drug supply, allow us to share the information and be respond to those kind of situations. And mental health substance use, including overdose agonist treatments, it continues to be quite effective and make a huge difference how much risk a person might be at. And we also really seen that when people that unfortunately die from that toxicity of that unregulated drug, it's usually when they are alone, using it alone or not connected, so that those measures connecting them into some kind of social connections and care and network has continued to be an important part of our response.
So I spoke with Emily Claire Rattay. And one thing that her party are, they've basically labeled involuntary care as the primary response to the end of decriminalization and I guess just the toxic drug overdose epidemic in the province. What's Northern Health's take on a measure of something like involuntary care for people who are obviously suffering from addiction and that being an approach?
I think that the overall, that any kind of individual measures, it's a part of that collection of the response we do in connection to each other and really focusing on those people and the family and the community and how do we actually support address health issues of that those person, and particularly for the Northern Health, how do we support those health issues through the health care that we can provide and connect when they need and those kind of cares. So those particular measures, we listen closely to some of the kind of the experts, subject matter experts kind of discussions and some of the guidance recommendation coming out. And we also look for when public policy and directions, as well as some of the resource kind of support is coming out. And we will ensure that those collection and the package of the response that we will implement to support these significant health situations.
I understand. Was there anything that I didn't ask about the effects of the end of decriminalization or Northern Health? Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you think is important to include in this conversation?
Just acknowledging that we continue to have significant emergency and deaths from this unregulated drug poisoning, and we grieve those kind of loss of lives we are having, that and also that appreciation and gratitude of that the families and communities and those partners really working and supporting in these emergencies. And we will continue to work in response to these emergencies and doing what works. That we've seen the differences being made to the community members and providers and community partners through including like harm reduction treatments and kind of supporting environments.
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, Dr. Kim, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No, Nero, thank you so much. This is an important matter, so really appreciate that kind of reach out and get able to have this conversation in support of our community.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Very interesting report there. Digging into some of the issues around decriminalization and ending decriminalization.
Well, a brief point I'll make. When that legislation existed, which it just recently stopped being so, some people were saying it wasn't enough. Like a lot of the users saying, well, that we really want to have a bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And there was a criticism of that. So that's my point on this issue.
Well, I know some of the concerns and when the program first started was that some folks were apparently reselling the drugs they were provided, because that was part of the program. They would be given, you know, safe supply. The other, you know, other issues were open use in parks where families might be.
Yeah, so that was repealed. I don't know how long
ago. Yeah. It's a difficult issue, because obviously the drug crisis continues to go on. People are dying in great numbers every year from toxic drugs.
But the reselling of it, which, yeah, I hadn't really heard before, that was maybe the reasons why they said, well, this is how much you can have.
Yeah.
And then there, a lot of, as I said before, it was that they said, well, they need a bit more than that. And no, you're going to say they're going to be stuck legally for having what they need. Anyway.
Yeah. Difficult issue. I hope the government is able to come up with a new approach is going to be effective. I mean, one of the things they're introducing is compulsory treatment, or not compulsory, but you know, where people will be taken off the streets and detained in some fashion. And we'll see how that works. I know a lot of people who advocate for drug users are very much opposed to that. A lot of other people think maybe it's needed. Difficult issue. I'm not really an expert. But
a brief point is that some people are taking these illegal drugs because of pain issues.
Yeah.
They had an injury, which I don't have now, and that's what it is. Suppose, yeah. I think that it is at sometimes. So maybe it's given a bad rap because they're not. There is sort of a reason why and how much you're being allowed to take of certain prescription painkillers, yeah, is sort of moderated, so on.
Anyway, I'm sure we'll be talking about this again, and perhaps we'll see about bringing someone into the show in the next few weeks to talk more about this issue, who's more of an expert than we are, because it really is not an easy. If there's an easy solution, we would have gone there already, and. We're still obviously casting about for how to deal with this appropriately as a society, and seemingly not doing that great a job at finding that solution. Let's take a quick look at the weather for Vancouver this week. We had a beautiful sunny weekend, and we got a bit more sun today, but then we're going to shift into clouds with rain showing up on Wednesday. Highs climbing a little higher than we've seen on the weekend, getting up to 8, 9, and 10 degrees towards the end of the week. So back into our typical January, February weather. So if you've been leaving your umbrella and raincoat behind, you might want to start taking that with you when you head out into the world. Here is Bird Note, and then we'll be back to talk about the trucker convoy, the state of emergency declared by the government, and the court case that says the government wasn't right.
This is Bird Note. In temperate climates like North America, it's often male songbirds that sing the most. Typically, the males migrate north before females and establish territories for the short breeding season, using their songs as a way to claim a spot. But many female birds do sing, even in colder climates, such as this canyon wren. And in the warm tropic zones, it's a different story. Birds typically stay in the same breeding territory year-round rather than just a few months. That may have helped lead to a different behavior pattern. Females in the tropics can have a big role in defending a territory, and many of them sing, often just as loudly and artfully as the males. Some species even blend male and female songs in a complex duet, like these bay wrens. And when you look at songbirds as a whole, it's the pattern in the tropics that's the rule, not the exception. Both females and males sing in the majority of songbird species, about 64%, according to one study. Scientists have created the Female Songbird Project to help track female birdsong throughout the world. Learn how you can participate at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
Just over a week ago, an appeal launched by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association against the federal government's imposition of the Emergency Act during the trucker convoy a few years back was successful. The government lost the appeal, and the decision held that the government had overstepped when imposing the Emergency Act. And there's a quote from the ruling here that from the judge in the ruling: there was no evidence that the lives, health, and safety of the people living in Ottawa were endangered, as annoying and stressful and concerning as the protests were, reads the court's decision. So, of course, the trucker convoy descended on Ottawa and basically blocked up the downtown for about 6 weeks.
Now, that's a key thing, downtown. I lived in Ottawa from September 1978 to June 1980. I lived in Ottawa. Otherwise, it's been Vancouver. Now I live in Burnaby. What it is that the downtown is where they have the House of Parliament. And you go, I can't figure out what's northeast and south in Ottawa, like in here, lower mainland. You look at the mountains, it's north. But then... now it's called the Museum of like Nature. It was the Museum of Man in those days. So that's sort of the downtown. You got the House of Parliament over to the Museum of Nature. The trucker convoy just went halfway.
Yeah.
Primarily not a residential area.
Yeah.
Now then, sometimes when you're down on a main street, I mean like Broadway down in Vancouver, mainly businesses.
Yeah.
A few people live on top, but not a lot. There was this one woman, understandably, she was complaining about all the noise, but...
because they were often honking their horns.
I'm saying it was primarily, that's primarily not a residential area.
Yeah.
And the media kind of implied that, I feel, that it was, and it's not... because I've been there. The other thing was that as low as $50 donation got your bank account frozen. Maybe not all the time.
Yeah.
But when there have been cases, some people say even as low as 25, but we'll go with 50. And that also concerned people who were part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So... I don't
like families of people affected.
Yes, or you know, connected, joint accounts, and so on.
Yeah.
Now, Magnus, do you think that was right? A $50 donation to be having their bank account frozen?
It does seem extreme, and a lot of people felt that. And it does seem to perhaps been true that it was a particularly coercive sort of act. To freeze people's bank account, because that basically makes it so you can't function, you know, to support yourself in society when that happens to you.
And I mean, if it was a $10,000 and up, maybe there'd be some argument. Also, maybe saying, well, from outside of Canada, people donating. I think it was like they said 53% came to the United States.
Yeah.
But not to do something as low as $50, mm-hmm. or even like I would say under $1,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any reason for doing that. The other thing is that a lot of us didn't really know what was going on. I've studied it a bit afterwards. The lab leak theory was a contention. A variety of things. The other thing that I found very odd was that once the trucker convoy ended, then all the restrictions ended too. A few months later, mm-hmm. seemed a bit odd to me that happened that way. I don't know if you remember at the time. It was like
not specifically,
but it did. It was sort of, and it was even a worldwide kind of ending of it. We were big on Canada was big on Fox News for a while because Tucker Carlson loved it, and somebody knew had Fox.
Yeah.
So I was seeing that, but I guess times have changed. How much are you remembering of Justin Trudeau, Magnus? Do you just want to forget him, or were you a fan? I don't know.
I wouldn't call him a fan, but I think he did a lot of good things during his term. I think he clearly had sort of worn out his welcome by the end. But
I think he was a rather arrogant personality overall, and I think. At the beginning, he was on television every day, radio and TV every day.
Yeah.
Which I don't think Joe Biden was. No, it was actually Trump in those days. Yeah. Trump. So he was sort of part of it. I think that the Liberal Party, especially at that time, was sort of, he was sort of the leader of it.
Yeah.
Despite... He doesn't have the background, except for being his father, of your usual politician. He doesn't have a law degree. He really doesn't have a history of business. He was a school teacher.
Yeah.
And he just was a nepotistic appointment by the federal liberals. And they kind of figured, well, he has the brand name. And in 2015, I think that the Stephen Harper government got kind of arrogant. People were getting, and they just thought they were going to end there forever. And so he came in there, and
to be fair, I mean obviously he was able to ride into the leadership on a lot on the name, but he also in that 2015 came, they were. Looking like, at the start of the campaign in August, when the writ was dropped, they were looking like they were going to end up in third place. And, him as the face of the party did run a campaign, and they were able to, come right up the middle there and end up in front of both the Conservatives under Harper and the NDP, who are looking like they might end up in the second place. So... despite the fact that, you could say he's a bit of a Nepo baby, he also turned that election. He didn't get handed a winning card to him at the beginning of the election.
Well, I would argue more so because I think I remember that campaign. You know how people have their little rented offices for the campaign? And, you go there, you talk to them. Both sides think the two-faced I can be at a campaign.
Yeah.
The Conservatives did not have any of that in 2015. They were just thinking that we're going to go on forever. And they were not engaging with the public, at least in the greater Vancouver area that I could have seen. And I think that's sort of where Justin Trudeau got his shoehorn in.
Mm-hmm.
And but the problem was, I just think that I have seen what he did. Two things. He said, okay, the Conservatives wanted pensions to go from 65 to 67. They stopped that. Passing legalization of marijuana, I think, was good. Other than that, really no. And I think he had a bad bedside manner because that's what the COVID was in a sense. And that whole trucker convoy... They had sort of a bad leader, leading the charge against those who kind of questioned things.
It was a messy situation. I mean, there were a lot of really strong supporters for the convoy. There were a lot of people who really disliked it and what they represented. And I think that's part of why the government felt they were able to take this step. The other part was, of course, they were it set up some blockades at the border near with Detroit and one in Alberta, and that was threatening too. I guess the final word, because we're running out of time here, that I would say is I'm just glad that within our system here in Canada that we have a way of reviewing these things and holding the government to account. There was a commission that met afterwards to decide to review it. There's these court cases, and that sets a standard for the future.
Yes.
All right. That's it for today. Thanks. My name is Magnus Thiebold.
With Peter R. H.
Peter R.